this is going to be more about the dependent origination, but this is going to be basically how the Buddha came up with the links of dependent origination. Monks, before my awakening, while I was still a bodhisattva, not yet fully awakened, it occurred to me, alas, this world has fallen into trouble, in that it is born ages and dies, it passes away and is reborn, yet it does not understand the escape from suffering, headed by aging and death. When will an escape be discerned from the suffering? That's better. Headed by aging and death. Then it occurred to me, when what exists does aging and death come to be? By what is aging and death conditioned? Then monks, through careful attention, there came to me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is birth, aging and death comes to be. Aging and death has birth as its condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does birth come to be? By what is birth conditioned? When, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is habitual tendency, birth comes to be. Birth has habitual tendency as its condition. So he's going through all of the links by figuring out how they actually work. I mean, he had a brilliant mind. Even to consider that, how many people do you know of that even think about this sort of thing? Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does habitual tendency come to be? By what is habitual tendency conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is clinging, habitual tendency comes to be. Habitual tendency has clinging as its condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does clinging come to be? By what is clinging conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is craving, clinging comes to be. Clinging has craving as its condition. Now, one of the things that's happened in Buddhism when I was spending so much time with straight vipassana was people just thought that on the night of his awakening, it just all came to him. And this is showing you how he actually saw. But he had to practice it. He had to practice using the six R's so that he could see and realize exactly how it happened. Pretty much by itself. So he sat figuring all of this stuff out, but he did not become awakened right then. He had to practice it before he could see it. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does craving come to be? By what is craving conditioned? Then, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is feeling, craving comes to be. Craving has feeling as condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does feeling come to be? By what is feeling conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is contact, feeling comes to be. Feeling has contact as condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does contact come to be? By what is contact conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there are the six sense bases, contact comes to be. Contact has the six sense bases as condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists do the six sense bases come to be? By what are the six sense bases conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is mentality, materiality, the six sense bases come to be. The six sense bases have mentality, materiality as their condition. And I'll get to explain each one of these links in a little bit. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does mentality, materiality come to be? By what is mentality, materiality conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is consciousness, mentality, materiality comes to be. Mentality, materiality has consciousness as condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does consciousness come to be? By what is consciousness conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there are formations, consciousness comes to be. Consciousness has formations as condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists do formations come to be? By what are formations conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is ignorance, formations comes to be. Formations have ignorance as their condition. Thus, with ignorance as condition, formations come to be. With formations as condition, consciousness. And then it goes dot, dot, dot. With consciousness as condition, mentality, materiality comes to be. With mentality, materiality as condition, the sixfold base comes to be. With the sixfold base as condition, with contact as condition, with feeling as condition, with craving as condition, with clinging as condition, with habitual tendency as condition, with birth as condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, and despair. I always have this image of these hellfire ministers, and yeah, like that when I read this. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. And then it goes into the cessation. But keeping up with Bhikkhu Bodhi, he does dot, dot, dot with all of this. But I'll read you the first paragraph. Monks, it occurred to me. Then, monks, it occurred to me. When what does not exist, does aging and death not come to be? With the cessation of what, does the cessation of aging and death come about? Then, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is no birth, aging and death does not come to be. With the cessation of birth comes the cessation of aging and death. Now, actually, according to what it said in earlier sutta about the two ways, this is the wrong order that it's talked about. Should be the cessation comes first, and then the origin. So, now we're going to go to another, this is called the analysis of dependent origination. Monks, I will teach you dependent origination and I will analyze it for you. Listen and attend closely to how I speak. Yes, venerable sir, those monks replied. The Blessed One said this. And what, monks, is dependent origination? With ignorance as condition?
Formations.
Comes to be. With formations as condition? With consciousness as condition?
Mentality.
With mentality, materiality as condition?
Sixfold.
With the sixfold base as condition?
Contact.
With contact as condition?
Feeling.
With feeling as condition?
Craving.
With craving as condition?
Clinging.
With clinging as condition? With habitual tendency as condition.
Birth.
With birth as condition. Aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair comes to be. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. And what, monks, is aging and death? The aging of various beings in various orders of beings, their growing old, brokenness of teeth, grayness of hair, we don't understand that part, wrinkling of skin, decline of vitality, degeneration of the faculties, this is called aging. The passing away of these various kinds of being from the various orders of being, their perishing, breaking up, disappearance, mortality, death, completion of time, breaking up of the aggregates, the laying down of the carcass, this is called death. Thus, this aging and death are together called aging and death. And what, monks, is birth? The birth of various kinds of beings into various orders of being. Their being born, descent into the womb. Production, manifestation of aggregates. The obtaining of the sense bases, this is called birth. Also, it is also talking about the birth of action in a practical way. So when you have habitual tendency arise, then you want to do some kind of action right after that because you get caught up in your emotional thinking. Now, last night he was talking about depression. And what do you do when you get depressed? You get into your poor me. And you try to control that feeling with thoughts, but it doesn't work. So then you do some kind of action, and what happens most often is people say, just leave me alone. And they go into a dark room, and they stay there for a period of time. Or they walk around with negative mental states. They walk around with complaining and just not being satisfied with what their life is like. So the question was, how do you overcome the depression? First, you have to understand how it works. A painful feeling arises. I don't like that painful feeling. I have a story about this painful feeling and get caught up in trying to control the painful feeling with thoughts. Now, when you start to learn how to use the six R's, what happens? A painful feeling arises, craving is there, and you relax right then. When that happens, you don't have clinging arise. And if clinging doesn't arise, habitual tendency doesn't arise. And now you're starting to see that this, in fact, is a process. And it's not personally yours. This isn't me. I didn't ask this feeling to come up. Did I sit down on a chair and say, you know, I haven't been depressed for a while. I might as well be depressed now. No, it happens because there is a process in mind, and it works exactly the way for all human beings. When you start seeing that feeling is not yours personally, then you start losing all of this other stuff that makes you feel worse and worse. And I've seen in some scientific papers that people, there's about 75% of the people in this country that have depression. Isn't that strange? How do you overcome depression? Use the six R's. Learn to smile. Learn to laugh. Help other people. And this is important. My mother, when I was growing up, she ran a nursing home. So I got to go up and help. And I got to meet some of the most fantastic people that were old. That was their only problem. They couldn't get around. They had trouble moving. So they were taken care of. But you go into a nursing home, and like this one man, John, he was 103. And I started asking him, what did you do with your life? What? Yeah, I was an engineer. What kind of things do you work on? Oh, I helped build the Panama Canal. Wow. Now, when you talk to somebody like that, and you find out what they did in their life, it's really fascinating. And you're helping them. They're lonely. They only see a very few people in the day. So you get them to remember their past experiences and start talking to them about it. And you find out the most interesting things. They had a big problem with malaria. And he had malaria two or three times while he was working on the engineering of the Panama Canal. I talked to another lady. She was at one time a very famous opera singer. And she said she used to sing in front of 2,000 or 3,000 people at a time. When you start extending yourself to other people, you don't have time to be depressed. It doesn't come up because you know you're doing something good for somebody else and you're extending outside of yourself. What is depression really? It's poor me. I don't like this feeling. I don't want this feeling. This makes me sad. Well, go make other people smile. Why do I tell you I want you to smile all the time? And give your smile away. Because you're extending outside of yourself. And you start caring for other people. And it's easy to have friends when you're smiling. And people, when they see you, they start to perk up and go, oh, yeah, here's my friend. And you're helping them. You're helping them to overcome depression. You can listen to their stories, which are completely fascinating. And that helps their mind to be uplifted. They're not so caught up in, I'm old, I'm useless, nobody cares about me. But I went to the nursing home every day. I got to meet some really fascinating characters. Ah, but I don't want to do something like that. I'd rather stay at home and be bummed out and then complain about the way the world is. Well, go out and change it. Change the world around you. Radiate loving kindness. I used to spend, after I went to a meditation center, I lived in Hawaii, and then I came back and I wanted to see what it was like to be with somebody that died. So my mother was very used to being around people that died because about once a week somebody in the nursing home died. There was 50 people in the nursing home that were being taken care of. So she would tell me, in 3 or 4 days this person is going to die. So I would go in, and I was a complete stranger to them. I would be radiating loving kindness to them. And I said, are you Christian? Yes. Would you mind if I started reading the Bible to you? And I had some special verses that I went to, and one of them was, in the Bible, it has the precepts. So I would read the precepts to them. And I said, you know, this is pretty good stuff. And I would tell them, you know, it's a good thing to repeat that every now and then because it helps your mind be uplifted. So I would do that every now and then. And I would get with some people that had Alzheimer's and they just had no memory at all. And then I'd start talking to them, if they could talk, about some of the things that they did. And their mind came back. And I would share merit with them. And they would be really coherent for a period of time. How do you help the world be a better place to live? You be better. You give to other people. That's what generosity is. It doesn't necessarily mean material things. Quite often, material things don't mean anything. But you give your attention. And you get them to start remembering times when they were happy. times when they did things with their family that was real special. And then as they get closer to death, you remind them of those times. And, well, there's a thing in Buddhism that says that right before you die, you start to have visions. Okay? And there's five different kinds of visions. If you have anger in your mind, then you're going to have a vision of fire. If you have greed in your mind, and in some cultures, if you die on a bed, you have to be buried with it, or you're cremated with the bed, and they want to be taken off the bed so that the bed can be used by somebody else. And then they would have a vision of, quite often it was a black, hairy, ogre kind of vision. Sometimes people that die have visions of their animals. Sometimes they have visions of people in their family that had already died. Sometimes they have visions of heavenly beings. Now, if you're reborn with anger in your mind, you're going to go to a place that's not going to be very pleasant, not necessarily a fire hell realm, but it's going to be some kind of hell realm, because that's the last vision that you had. So as they were getting closer to death and they could still speak, I asked them if they have any visions. Do you see anybody around? This one man, I was working at a hospice too at the same time. This one man, he started yelling, "No, no, get away. I don't want to be around you." And I said, "What's happening?" He said, "This black hairy beast is pulling me away." So what did I tell him to do? Take the precepts. I undertake the precept not to kill. I undertake the precept not to steal. And that is so wholesome that that vision would change to one of their family members or even a heavenly, like a chariot that comes down. And if I could keep their mind uplifted, they would have a good rebirth. And I wanted to see if this was true. I wanted to see if these visions were real or not. So I spent almost a year just being with people as they were dying. Sometimes the family would come in as they were dying. They didn't know me from anybody, so I'd get up and leave. But always, right before I left, I shared my merit with them and reminded them to think happy thoughts. This one day, this lady had brain cancer, and she was getting close to death. It was going to happen within an hour or so. And even though she was in a coma, I still said that out loud. The family came, I left. And I was walking down the hallway, and somebody tapped me on the shoulder. I looked around. Nobody's there. As soon as they tapped me, strong joy. And I turned around and went back to the room, and that lady had just died. Smiling. Great stuff. You want to get over depression? Go help someone else. Practice your loving kindness the whole time. That is a major part of the Buddha's teaching. Don't be self-absorbed. Find somebody else that needs help and do it. Now, it was an interesting thing during that time. I was making $100 a week, take home pay, $100 a week. This was in 79, something like that. $100 a week went further than it does now. And I was staying at my mother's house, but I was giving her half of what I was making. So I gave her $50 a week. And there was a lady there that she had a disease where her brain was shrinking and she was losing her memory. And I thought, maybe we can get the circulation going a little bit if she'd had some acupuncture. So I went to the family and I said, I want to take her and get some acupuncture treatments to see if it can help her. And they said, fine, you can do that, but we're not going to pay for it. So I did. $35 a week. That's $85, right? I sent $10 a week to a monastery in India that I wanted to see grow. I spent $10 a week by just giving my mother a $10 bill. That's $105. I always had money in my pocket. I walked everywhere I wanted to go. And I was really healthy. And I took care of Dhamma. I never got everything I wanted, but I got everything I needed. I was driving 35 miles a week to teach a meditation class. I had no idea the day I was going to teach the meditation class how to get there. But somebody would come along and say, I'm going to San Diego. You want to come? Yeah, sure. Great. I live like that for 8 months. How do I do that? By helping other people to be happy. When you take care of Dhamma, Dhamma always takes care of you. I told other people about this and they say, it's impossible. You can't live that way. But I did. I was spending 8 hours a day at the nursing home, or if they were getting close to dying at night, I would spend the whole night with them so they weren't alone. Sometimes the family could be there, sometimes they couldn't. I was helping to start a hospice. And every now and then I would get some extra money, I would give it to them. I always had what I needed. And this is a principle that is real. I mean, I lived it for 8 months. I never went without the things I needed. I didn't always get what I wanted, but it's a nice way to live. And then I decided I was going to come to Asia and ordain. And I thought, well, I'll just ordain for 1 year. And I immediately went to a meditation center, and after that, that's when I ordained. And then after about a year, I decided, well, I don't want to disrobe quite yet. That was 28 years ago. And the meditation center that we have, we didn't borrow any money to get the land. We got a deal on the land. We got 30 acres of land for $25,000. It's a little bit different in California, I understand. And now the land has gone up. It's really getting kind of expensive. It's $800 an acre now. And we always worried whether we were going to have enough money, for we paid quarterly, so it was about $875 a quarter. We never didn't have the money to pay for that. People started donating. They wanted to help. Now we have a dining hall. It's about this size, I think. It cost $250,000. I don't have any money. How did that get built? When you take care of Dhamma, Dhamma takes care of you. The next project was building the meditation hall. Somebody donated $45,000 to get it started. And it just happened. And it was about 200,000 by the time we were done. 165,000. We don't have any money. How did that happen? Spend all my time helping. That's how it happens. A lot of people worry about their finances. As soon as I became a monk, I didn't even think about money. I traveled all over the world. How do you do that? My family still doesn't understand how I do it. Well, how can you travel like that? Well, somebody sends me a ticket and invites me to come. That's how I come. And they just kind of shake their head and go, that's impossible. I said, well, come and see our meditation center. It's really pretty fantastic. It's pretty neat. This year, somebody decided that what we do, we needed another cabin. So they donated the money for the cabin. So as soon as we get back, we're going to start working on fixing it up and putting electricity in and all that sort of thing. They see the Dhamma as a valuable thing. And they want to support it. That's how we do that. David is our treasurer, and sometimes we get low on funds. He starts worrying a little bit and comes. And he comes to me and he said, well, we only got enough money for one more month. Because we have electricity bills and food, and we have somebody that we pay to help us because he's a carpenter and a jack of all trades. He's really good. And I said, that's okay. I don't care. Don't worry about it. Money will come. He did it one time, and the next day, a friend in San Diego sent us or donated to us 10 gold coins. So we went from almost being broke, oh my God, what are we going to do, to having $15,000 or whatever it was. And that's the way it works. Don't worry about it. Now he doesn't come and worry about it as much as he did, because he knows that something's going to happen. Because we spend our time on the computer giving retreats by email and writing, and I spend 5 or 6 months a year going around the world helping other people. So when you take care of Dhamma and you extend to other people, Dhamma takes care of you. And what's happening right now is in a couple of different countries, people are starting to say, well, we want a Dhamma Sukha Center in our country. So they're starting to build Dhamma Sukha Centers. And they ask if it's all right. And then they say, are you going to come and visit? Well, I have to if they're going to do that. But the Dhamma is growing at a very nice pace. I mean, the Dhamma that is sutta-based. And it's starting to catch on. One of the things that happened when I first came back to this country is I stayed in Washington, D.C. for about a year at a Sri Lankan temple. And that's where I met Sister Kema. And she started thinking about ways of advertising and get people all enthusiastic because she saw the benefit of doing this. And I told her, you know, when I give a talk to 100 people, if 2 people really understand, I consider that a very successful talk. And she's saying, 2 people? It's got to be more than that. And I said, I don't want to advertise. I want the Dhamma to grow so it has a good foundation, a strong foundation. And now it's happening. The first 2 retreats I gave was for 1 or 2 people. And look now. And I have complaints that we want to have more people come to your retreats. I can only handle so many. But then we have people that are successful with the meditation and they're starting to teach too. And that's just great. As long as whoever starts teaching teaches to smile and the 6 R's. So the Dhamma is growing at a very rapid rate right now. A lot of meditation centers, they have people that have gray hair that come to the meditation, but they don't have many young folks. In Indonesia, there must have been a dozen couples that had children and came to me and they said, can you give a retreat for our kids? Well, yeah, of course. So this coming year, we're going to give a retreat for about 35 people under 20 years old. Sometimes the families will come, you know, all the kids will come and mom and dad are doing the meditation. And they have two or three kids. There is this one family that was remarkable. Had a 12-year-old girl and a 10-year-old boy came to the retreat. The 12-year-old girl became a Sotapanna. And she said, "Am I the youngest person that you've taught and was successful?" And I said, "Yes." And 2 days later, her 10-year-old brother, and he was successful and became a Sotapanna. So I told her she wasn't the youngest anymore. But this can happen for any age people. I had one lady, 81 years old. It was not even a residential retreat. She went home every night. And she got it. She became more than a Sotapanna. It's amazing. And it's not because of me. It's not because of, quote, my teaching. It's because I found out the importance of reading the suttas. Because they're really systematic. They give it to you the way it should be given to you. And you start understanding it. And you start paying attention. In the last 3 years, people are really starting to get it. And as I told you before, and this is not bragging on my part because they did all the work. All I did was read a book to them. Half of the people in 3 different retreats were successful. They became at least Sotapannas. That's remarkable. Just because I'm willing to read what it says in the suttas. And you're starting to get it now. Some people are being quite successful. Great stuff. Really makes me happy. So, the whole thing with depression is you have to learn not to be selfish. You have to learn to give. Give kind words. You know, you go in a line and the cashier is there, and that's a hard job. And they have to be doing all this stuff, and some people are not happy with this, and, oh, I got to change this, and I got to do that. And you say something to them about how you appreciate what they're doing. You're practicing your generosity. You're getting rid of the self-centeredness that happens so much in this country right now. And you're helping them. And they're happy when you leave with other people right behind you for a little while. Then they'll get caught up in their old habitual tendencies, but they were happy for a moment because you took the time to appreciate them as a human being. That's how you overcome depression. Smiling, laughing, helping other people to laugh. Being with people when they're suffering. You don't even have to say something sometimes. Just being with them is enough. But what are you doing with your mind? You start radiating loving kindness to them. Whether they're strangers or not. Everybody that's a human being wants the same thing. Everybody. They all want to be loved. So, give it to him. That's how you affect the world around you. That's what this teaching is about. In India, during the time of the Buddha, I think I might have mentioned this before. I've done it in a few retreats, and I get them mixed up whether I did it or not. The way they measured wealth was not by how much money they could hoard and have themselves, but by how much they gave. My mother was a pretty remarkable person. She really had strong compassion. So, for a few months, when it got to be either Thanksgiving or Christmas, for a few months before that, she'd start buying two or three cans of food and putting them in a box. And then somebody that had gone through a rough time, we'd take the box, put it on the steps, and walk away. Help other people. One of the things that the Buddha said was, if you saw the advantage you get by feeding other people, you would never eat alone. Why are you in this country right now? There's plenty of food. But you're in this country right now, you're not in Africa starving to death because in the past you shared your food. Share it with everybody. When I was at a meditation center right after one of the teachers from India had left, every time we sat down at a table with him, he would take food off of his plate and put it on yours. What are you doing that for? I can take that if I want it. Oh, I like to give. So the more you can practice that, the more prosperous you become, the more uplifted you become, the more satisfied and content life becomes. So, you want to overcome something as simple as letting go of depression? Radiate loving kindness when you're walking down the street. Wish people happiness. Share your food with other people. It's great fun. One of the hardest things I had to do when I became a monk was to accept whatever anybody gave to me. It's easy to give. But as a monk, I couldn't refuse what somebody else gave me. It didn't matter whether it was food or some people, they know that I like art kind of stuff, so they give me pictures and they give me all different kinds of clothes. They give me all kinds of things. As a matter of fact, when I'm in Indonesia, people give me so much stuff that we have to ship it by boat to come back. Some of this stuff I buy. But a lot of the things people give, they see that I like something and they're with me when I'm in a shop. And I say, well, let's get these two vases or something like that. And I have an attendant that has money that they're taking care of. And I say, go ahead and pay for that. Somebody else will come along and say, no, I want to buy that for you. That sort of thing happens a lot. When somebody wants to give you a gift and you turn your nose up at it, it's like you're slapping them in the face. I thought enough of you that I want to give you a present. Well, I don't like that. I don't want it. What? How selfish can you be? Well, it doesn't match my other things. So what? When somebody gives you something, if you don't want it, or you don't need it, or you don't have room to store it, give it to somebody else. You want to be prosperous? It's easy to be prosperous. I'm one of the most prosperous persons I know, and it doesn't have anything to do with money. I mean, I do travel all over the world. Why? Because I give. And I'm a chronic giver. Material things don't really hold that much of a big deal to me. Somebody gives me some fruit, I see somebody that would enjoy it, I give it to them. No problem. I told you, I have good food karma because I give food a lot. And I make sure that anybody that comes to my center is going to get the kind of food that they can eat. So I'm taking care in a lot of different ways. Now, all of this comes back down to getting over depression. Do you see what I'm saying? Get out of yourself and help somebody else to smile and feel good. Now, there's a place in Boulder Creek called HeartMath, and they have these machines that can measure the energy when you're radiating loving kindness. And this machine says that when you start radiating loving kindness, the loving kindness affects everybody around you for 500 feet. And I don't believe it. Why? Right after I became a monk, my teacher had a stroke. He was in Half Moon Bay. And he was in the hospital, and as soon as I heard about that, I started radiating loving kindness. When he got out of the hospital, he wrote me a note. He wasn't big on letters, but that's the Asian way. And he thanked me for sending him loving kindness. How did he know? You affect the world around you by your mental states. You indulge in anger. What are you doing to the world around you? You indulge in selfishness? What are you doing with the world around you? You indulge in happiness? What are you doing with the world around you? You can't blame somebody else for the world condition. The world condition around you is what you can affect. So affect it in a positive way. This is one of the reasons that I'm trying to get across to you, that you don't just do this while you're sitting in meditation. This is an all-the-time practice. There's a couple that they were the ones that were instrumental in me going to Indonesia. The wife was Indonesian, and she married an American. Right before they got married, The man's father came to him and he said, do you want to have a successful marriage where you're not fighting and you're not bickering? Because that happens a lot. And he said, yeah, what do I have to do? And he said, it's real simple. Everything your wife says is right. And you let her be right, even though she's dead wrong. You don't fight with her about it. You let her be right, and then you can discuss what her ideas are. They've been married 7 years. They have not had a fight in 7 years. Can anybody else say that that's married? I mentioned this at another retreat. And a man piped up and he said, well, I want to be right some of the time. She's not always right. So he said, how about if I'm right Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Sunday, and she's right Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday? No, you'll forget about that. Let the woman be right. It doesn't matter. That takes the confrontation out of your relationship, and it makes it so easy. There's no complaining. They sit down and discuss things without any emotional upset. Sometimes they can agree, sometimes they can't, and they agree to disagree. And they don't start complaining because, well, you're doing it this way. No, just let it go. What difference does it make? So there's a lot of things that you can do to overcome depression or anger or dissatisfaction. You can overcome this easily by not taking these things personally. Somebody else's opinion, even if they come at you with anger and they come at you with dissatisfaction, they can do that, and I can still be happy. They say things that are incredibly hurtful. They can do that. That's their opinion. That doesn't mean it's right. And it doesn't mean that I have to defend myself. But what do you do when somebody comes at you like that? You start sending them loving kindness because you see that they're suffering. What's compassion? Seeing somebody else suffer and love them without any other conditions. Just love them because they're there. Radiate loving kindness. You'd be surprised how much better your relationships become when you can remember to do that. That's what being content is all about. What's the definition of contentment? I looked it up in the dictionary. Being happy. Why isn't life like that? Because we like to take things personally, and we like to make things complicated, and we like to make things be the way we want them to be when we want them to be that way. But that leads to suffering, and you're doing it to yourself. Remember, that's what a meditation retreat is about. Doing it so often that you can remember to do it when you get off retreat. I had one of my students in Malaysia was a school teacher. In Malaysia, they still use a cane. And a cane is, it's like almost like a whip. and it's really painful. And it's okay if the kids are misbehaving enough that they get caned once or twice. And she was assigned being the head of discipline for the whole school. So these kids would get in a fight and they had to come to her. And after she started practicing with me and I started telling her that she had to start radiating loving kindness, there wasn't so many kids that were coming to her. And they weren't afraid to talk to her about what their problems were. And she would start teaching these kids from some of them 6 and 7 years old on up to teenage. She was teaching them loving kindness, and she changed the whole school. And they started taking an interest in learning, not resisting. They'd find something that they liked about the class, and she encouraged that. And as a result, they became very good students. And they would go home, and they would tell their parents, "Oh, we learned how to send love to other people today. Let's do that." So you can affect the world around you just by being nice and helping other people and radiating loving kindness to them. Life starts to be fun. And the Dhamma starts taking care of you. So you don't have to worry. You don't have to even think about problems. You can let it go. It's pretty amazing. And quite often, something that I need, I start thinking about it before I can do anything or tell somebody else that I'd like to have that, they come and give it to me. When I was in Australia, I went there and it was the shortest day of the year there. And I went from Malaysia where it was like, oh, it was probably 85 Fahrenheit. And I went to Australia, and it was probably 40. And I was not prepared for cold weather. I had on real light robes. I didn't have any socks. And as I was walking around, I started thinking, boy, it would really be nice to have a pair of socks. My feet are so cold. And I finally got to this monastery, and the first thing the head monk did was give me a pair of socks. And I said, "All right." In a week, I had a dozen pair of socks. And literally, I was walking around going, "I don't need any more socks. Please stop the socks." And to this day, people still give me socks. So I get to give socks away to other people. And quite often what you give, you get. So I keep having them come back. So practicing your generosity in all different ways is how you overcome depression. And you start getting more healthy. Keeping the precepts is a real important thing to do. It's real good because it's a kind of protection for you. A lot of people come and they say, "I want to teach this stuff. What do I have to do to learn that?" Keep the precepts. Be the example. Show other people the compassion that you're cultivating all the time. That's how you teach other people. People learn by example. especially children. They see you fighting with mom or dad, then all of a sudden they're fighting with brother or sister. But they see loving and kind, then they want to get in the middle of it. I want some of that. That's good stuff. And they start appreciating other people around them. So, this practice is life-changing if you practice it, if you do it. You will be prosperous. You'll get what you need. Not always what you want, but what you need. We started out with 30 acres. We have 102 acres because somebody donated the money to get another piece of land. That's how it works. So the birth of action can be positive or negative, depending on you and your perspective. And if you want to have a pure mind, you need to use the six R's. And you need to use the six R's all the way down to letting go of ignorance. Then Nibbana occurs. So the more you practice this and use the six R's during the day, when your mind starts to get tight or you start to have an emotional thing arise, you need to use the six R's and you need to laugh. Oh, I have one student that is very highly emotional. And she comes running to me and she says, "I am so sad. I've really hurt a lot. What can I do with that?" So I said, "Laugh." "I can't laugh now. I'm in pain." So I start laughing. I said, "Listen to how ridiculous this is. You're taking all of these thoughts and feelings personally. Isn't that funny?" And I keep laughing, and before long, she's laughing, and then she's not emotional. She's not in pain anymore. How do you affect the world around you? The whole thing with mindfulness is remembering to do it. Remembering the six R's. Remembering to laugh at how crazy this thing is. Every time it takes something personally. That makes me mad. Isn't that funny? I mean, really. Did you tell yourself, "It's time to be mad now. I'm going to yell at everybody and I'm going to make people hate me because I'm so mad"? Isn't that funny? How dumb can it be? It's not you. It's not yours. It's just a crazy mind taking off. But practice makes perfect eventually. And the times when it's hardest to do that is when you really need to do it the most. You want to overcome depression? See? It's easy. It's not such a big deal. "Ah, but I have chronic depression." Okay. Then figure out how it works. Help somebody else that really has problems. Because depression is a made-up thing in your mind. It really is. And something that you're taking personally. Help other people, you stop thinking about yourself. Make other people happy. Figure out ways to make them laugh. Life starts to be fun then. Not only for you, but other people around you. I like to catch a hold of the guy that said that you're supposed to be serious. Life is serious. I like to catch a hold of it and just beat the heck out of him. Wrong. Okay, I'm going to get off my soapbox now. So, let's get back to the links of dependent origination. And what, monks, is habitual tendency? Now, when I say habitual tendency in this, what I'm doing is just taking the practical aspects that you can see and recognize. But there is more to this than just the emotional tendency. It's also wanting to get into different jhanas or arupa jhanas. You want to get rid of this kind of existence for that kind of existence. So, and I've been around a lot of scholar monks, and I ask them, what's a better word? The word in Pali is bhava. And what's a better word to describe than existence? How can you describe this better? So they start talking about using other words. And in my mind, what I'm doing is replacing what the word that they're saying, existence, and change it to habitual tendency. And I listen to them go through the whole definition of it by just changing habitual tendency, and it works. And then I'll tell them, well, I agree with what you're saying, what your definition is. And when I replace the idea of habitual tendency, it works too. And all of the scholars that I've really talked to about this, they've all agreed, yeah, this is a good definition, but it's not a complete definition. And I find that okay. Because when you start thinking about the emotional habitual tendencies and how much pain you cause yourself because of trying to think pain away, it's a practical definition. It's not going to be 100% correct, but that's okay, because you need to have the kind of language that is easy to understand. Now, if I say existence, what does that mean? You know? So, okay. Now, and what, monks, is clinging? There are four kinds of clinging. Clinging to sensual pleasures. Clinging to views. Now, this is the one that I say, this is your story, your thoughts, your opinions, your ideas. Clinging to rules and vows. there is a phenomena that happens with monks. And some monks are really interested in the rules of discipline, and they're very, very strict with them. And they get arguing with other monks about, is this really so or not? And they start fighting because of the rigidity of, it says it here, it's this way, and that's the way it is. There's not an openness of thinking. And people that take vows and they have their rites and rituals, you have to do it this way. If you don't do it this way, you're wrong. And that causes an awful lot of suffering in your own mind when you're over rigid. Now, when I talk about, and tomorrow I think I'm going to bring up a sutta about the Eightfold Path, I change the words. Instead of right, which is part of the definition of sama, I change it to harmonious. Okay, so you're in harmony with your opinions and ideas. That means you're not fighting with anyone. They can have a difference of opinion. They can say, you got to do it this way. But if you're in harmony, it's more peaceful. It's more calm. It leads to more balanced mind. And as I said, I'll do more of that tomorrow. And clinging to, this says a doctrine of self, but clinging to taking things personally. This is called clinging. And what, monks, is craving? There are these six classes of craving. Craving for forms, craving for sounds, craving for odors, craving for taste, craving for tactile objects, craving for mental phenomena. This is called craving. Now, this is a definition that's hard to understand because of the way it's presented. You have six sense doors, okay? Every time one of those sense doors arises, it causes a feeling to arise, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Right after that is where that craving is. And craving is always, I like, I don't like. This is the start of suffering. This is where it's best if you can remember the six R. If you can't, get caught up in the other stuff, and then six R. But always when you let go of the craving, there is this moment of no thoughts, very clear mind. One of the things that happens with six R's, because I talk about it so much, is that some people try to use six R's to beat things away. It's like it's a stick. And it's, I don't like this feeling. Six R, six R, six R. But it doesn't go away. It's not supposed to go away. It does on its own. When you go deeper in your practice, you'll get to a place where you'll see the very beginning of something arise, and you six R right then, and it keeps arising. But you don't keep your attention on it. You keep your attention on your object of meditation. Then it fades away by itself. You don't use the six R's as some kind of control to make things be the way you want it to be. When you use that relaxed step, you might not notice it, but right after that, there is no thoughts for a short period of time. And then you have to bring up something wholesome. I've had a lot of students that after retreat, they go home and they say, Well, this problem came up. And I released and I relaxed and I released and I relaxed and it didn't go away. Well, of course it didn't go away. Why? You're not using the formula. You have to use the whole formula for it to work. Lighten your mind, smile. Come back to something wholesome. Or stay with the smile if that's the case. Keep doing that wholesome thing. Yeah, but that pain is still there. Okay, then do it again. But not immediately. You have to bring up the wholesome. Nature abhors a vacuum. When you six are, the craving is gone. Right? If you don't take that craving-free mind and bring up something wholesome, then it's going to go back to that unwholesome thing. So you have to use the whole formula. And it's not a control mechanism. But it didn't go away. That pain still stayed there. Okay, so what? If it pulls your attention to it, do it again. After you've come back to your object of meditation and developed the light mind. We cause ourselves a lot of problems when we repeat the thoughts. And why do repeat thoughts arise? This is me, this is mine. I don't like this. I want it to be different than it is. I want it to change the way I want it to change. 6 hours aren't for that. 6 hours are just for letting go of the identification, even if it's just for a short period of time. But you use the 6 hours all the way, coming back to an uplifted thought, coming back to a smile. That might not even stay for very long before you bounce back to it. To that pain. Okay, then do it again. Don't keep your attention on the pain because that's how you make it bigger. It grows. It gets stronger. So, be patient with the 6 hours. Patience leads to Nibbana. And it does. And I'll be patient as long as I get it the way I want it, when I want it that way. See how your mind feels when you laugh? Light. Alert. The more you smile, the more you laugh, the lighter your mind becomes. The more you have joy in your life, and life becomes fun. The person that does the interviews in Indonesia, she's just great. She really knows English well, and she's really good at translating. And she has to translate during the interviews and that sort of thing. So we're waiting for somebody to come. We're always giggling and laughing about nothing in particular. Just because it's fun. And people walk into the room and they hear us laughing and they start feeling better right then. So we're teaching by example. It's really nice. Great fun to be around her. And she's married, and it's not to do with anything except there's two human beings that really appreciate themselves, and they say things that we laugh with. I don't know if you've noticed, but when Doug and I are in there and David are in there, we're giggling and laughing about all kinds of weird things. You can hear us laugh before you even open up the door. How can we do that? Because we're having fun. Life is fun. We like to be happy. So we are. We practice it. So letting go of the craving is a major thing. And the more you can remember to do that without putting demands that think your reality be the way it's supposed to, you want it to be, or it, quote, should be. That's another word I want to take off out of the vocabulary, should. Because that's a judgment. I should have done it this way. Well, it's already done. It's gone. Why do you criticize yourself with a should? No need. Okay. And what monks is feeling? There are six classes of feeling. Feeling born of eye contact. Feeling born of ear contact. Feeling born of nose contact. Feeling born of tongue contact. Feeling born of body contact. Feeling born of mind contact. This is feeling. So there are six kinds of feeling, one at each of the sense doors. And actually, there's a sutta that there's 108 kinds of feeling. That's really getting picky. And what monks is contact? There are six classes of contact. Eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, and mind contact. This is called contact. And what monks are the six sense bases? The eye base, the ear base, the nose base, the tongue base, the body base, and mind base. And what monks is mentality and materiality? Now listen closely to this so you really can understand. Feeling, perception, contact, attention. This is called mentality. Feeling is mental, not physical. Feeling is mental. Okay, think about that for a little while. This is called mentality. The four great elements and the form derived from the four great elements. This is called materiality. Four great elements. Earth element, fire element, water element, air element. Okay. Everything material is made up of these in different degrees. That's what material form is. One of the things that's real interesting, during the time of the Buddha, there was a lot of people that were practicing different forms of yoga, and they didn't connect body and mind. They got their body in different postures, and they said it's all mental. But when the Buddha came along and said you can't have mind without body, that was pretty revolutionary at that time. And when you see that tightness in your mind and you relax, you're relaxing your body, but you're also relaxing your mind at the same time. Interesting, huh? Okay, and what is consciousness? There are these six classes of consciousness. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. This is called consciousness. Now, in the dependent origination, consciousness is the potential for those to arise. And when it arises is when the six, you have eye and form, and then eye consciousness arises. So you have this potential for all of these different kinds of consciousness to arise when there is that contact. And what monks are formations? There are these three kinds of formations: bodily formation, verbal formation, and mental formation. Okay? And that has craving in it too. And what, monks, is ignorance? Not knowing what suffering is. Not knowing the origin of the suffering. Not knowing the cessation of the suffering. Not knowing the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called ignorance. So now we've gone through all of the sense, all of the links of dependent origination. And because there is the origin of suffering in every one of the links, there is a slight bit of craving in that. So you have to keep your six R's going until you attain Nibbana. And then you get to a place where it's a cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. And that everything stops. Just for a short period of time. When the cessation, feeling, and consciousness arise, it's like a clean slate, and you can get to see how these links arise and how they cease. You get a great deal of relief. Really, like you've been carrying around a heavy weight your whole life and you didn't even know it. And then all of a sudden it's not there, and it's like, oh yeah, that's right. And then you have a lot of joy. And you feel so good you don't even want to, you come and tell me, I say, okay, you've experienced this. And you don't even want to go back and sit. I feel too good to do this. Don't care, still got to go. Got to go back to work. So again, this is how the whole process works. It's all conditioned. It all has some craving in it. And when you get to the unconditioned state, there is no more craving. There is no more ignorance. How do you describe Nibbana? I don't, most of the time. Because it's impossible. How can you describe an unconditioned state with conditioned words? Now, there is a thing in the Anguttara Nikaya that kind of gives you an idea. And it says that if you go to by the ocean and you build a sandcastle, that's like having the craving and all of the other stuff. And then a wave comes back and it knocks it down. Now, all of those individual pieces of sand are still there, but they can never be put together in exactly the same way. The thing that holds us together and causes us to be reborn continually is the craving and ignorance. That's what holds these aggregates together. And when you become an arahat, you don't have that anymore. When you die as an arahat, everything just dissipates. And you will not be reborn again. Think of that, not being on the wheel of samsara anymore. Sounds worthwhile. And the arahats they're probably some of the busiest people around, because they're spending all their time helping other people to get off of the wheel. Now think about this. If you go up to an arahat and ask him a question, he doesn't have any agenda, he doesn't have any craving, he doesn't have any ignorance. So the answer he's going to give you is going to be super clear. It's just your ability, whether you can hear what they're saying or not. It'd be nice to have one around, don't you think? I'm working on it. Why don't we share some merit now? May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired, for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect